You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of collected volume number 314 in Rudolf Steiner's collected works, his lectures on physiology and healing, translated by Anna Moise. This is lecture 2, given in Dornach on the 8th of October, 1920. Let me pick up where I concluded yesterday. Reference had been made to an individual who was driven by his philosophical instincts, as it were, from insight in the sphere of mind and soul, to a feeling that this sphere related to human existence in a physical body. This was Schelling, and I said that on the basis of these instincts, Schelling became involved, in practical terms, not only in the theory of medicine, but also with various forms of treatment. I do not know if this led to greater or less satisfaction, as is the case with physicians who are well prepared. For the question as to how much a treatment really contributes to a person's improvement is in most cases highly problematical, unless, of course, one takes the inner view. Schelling did, however, gain a principle in the state of soul engendered out of that instinct, a principle of which we may indeed say that it would be good if it were to become a kind of inner principle for every physician, so that the physician would develop the whole of his practical view of the nature of the human being in sickness and health on the basis of it. I gave you the words Schelling spoke. He simply said that to gain insight into nature was to create nature. I think you'll agree that the first thing to strike one when a man of genius says such a thing is that it is evidently absurd. No one would seriously believe that, as an earthly human being in a physical body, one would be able to create anything, whatever it may be, that exists in nature, by gaining insight into nature. Yes, people are creating things all the time in industry, but there it is not a question of truly creating something in the sense Schelling meant it, but merely of putting together, combining forces of nature that would give nature the opportunity to be creative herself in a particular way, in a specific arrangement. Essentially, therefore, we have here an absurdity on which a man of genius based really the whole of his thinking. And I quoted other words to you yesterday, words that may be seen as the opposite of, quote, to gain insight into nature is to create nature, close quote, which would be, quote, to gain insight into the spirit is to destroy the spirit, close quote. Schelling probably did not utter these in such a fundamental way. But when one is again taking up the science of the spirit in a different age, developing one's own spiritual investigation, one realizes that essentially both statements take us back to most ancient inspired insights. Schelling was not an initiate in any way, but simply a man of genius. He produced the one statement out of his own instincts. And when we do studies that were not done in Schelling's day, this statement immediately brings to mind echoes of the most ancient maxims. This then takes one to the other statement, coming to us as the echo of ancient maxims in a similar way. Both cannot be grasped with our ordinary understanding today. Seen side by side, or each on its own, they are really absurd. Yet they point to something of the greatest importance in the human organization, in both sickness and health. Looking at the natural world around us, the only thing we can say about finished processes in nature is that to gain insight into nature is, at best, to recreate nature in our thoughts. We thus really develop this principle, which we call our thoughts, and which can do no more than recreate nature, since it lacks the inner creative power in our thinking, in an inner life filled through and through with thoughts and ideas. But it has already been said that this inner life, filled with ideas, essentially is merely something which emancipates from the physical and etheric organization as the second teeth develop. Something human beings have inside their physical and etheric organism up to that time. The powers at work in that part of us are truly creative in early childhood. They then become attenuated, toned down in the inner life as a world of images or of thoughts and ideas. In short, I'd say as a cosmic power in our thoughts and ideas that is a dilution of the substantial creativity we had in our physical and etheric bodies. So the element which we come to know from our seventh year onward simply sits in our organism and organizes things in childhood. There it is, actively creative. This creative activity is not such that we can see it creatively at work in the natural world outside, but we see it there, being active in our own organism. If the child were to have wisdom already, and were able to speak not only about the natural world outside, but about the things happening inside him, and understand nature there, he would say what Schelling said. To gain insight into this nature is to create this nature. For the child would simply imbue himself with these creative powers, would be at one with them. And Schelling, with his medical instinct, his physiological instinct, did nothing else but take something which is an absurdity in the whole of later life, taking it from his childhood and pushing it out, saying, as it were, all this gaining of insight in adulthood is nothing but a feeble tissue of images. If one were able to gain insight as a child, one would have to say to gain insight is really to be active, to develop creative activity. We are, however, only able to see this creative activity in our own inner life. So what is it really, this creative activity within us? Something which a man of genius such as Schelling puts in words in the way I indicated. Now, I think you'll agree that genius altogether arises when someone keeps some childlike quality later on in life. People who age absolutely, taking to aging in a, in quotes, normal way when the relevant age is reached, will never have genius. It is people who take something positively creative and childlike into later life who actually have genius. This childlike quality, positively creative, this creativity based on insight, to put it in what is perhaps a foolish way, does not have the time to turn the search for insight to the outside, because it turns those powers of insight inward and becomes creative. This is the legacy we bring with us when we go through birth to enter into physical existence. And someone like Schelling felt this instinctively. Everyone who gains this kind of vision will know that these things are not, for instance, such that the powers of mind and soul that imbue the organism in childhood and organize it cease to be when the second teeth develop. They are merely going through a stage. They are, as it were, forced down to a smaller measure of activity. We do later on definitely continue to have organizing powers in us, but we have also gained powers to create memory. Those powers come to conscious awareness at second dentition, and so free themselves from the organization. Memory has then left the latent state and been released. And our powers of growth, of movement, of balance, have become powers of mental vision, which in early childhood had shown the higher degree of activity needed at that time. You can see from this that in normal human development, this organizing power, this power of growth, must be transformed in a particular way and taken down to a given level, to be powers of mind and soul, powers of memory, let us say, and the power to develop thought. If we assume, on the other hand, that due to some event or other, too much of this organizing power, active in childhood, is held back, with development simply taking a course where not enough of the organizing powers are transformed into memory-creating powers, then they are held fast down below in the organism, are not taken properly into sleep every time the individual goes to sleep, but continue to be active in the organism, bumbling about in the organism, from going to sleep to waking up. Doing physiological and phenomenological medical research in the direction which I can only refer to briefly in the short time available for these lectures, one comes to see that in the human organism it is possible for powers that should really go into the sphere of spirit and soul at the right time of life to stay down below in the physical organization. This creates the situation of which I spoke yesterday. If the normal measure of organizing powers is transformed at second dentition, we have a measure of powers in the organism later on in life that can fully organize this organism in its normal configuration and normal structure. But if we do not have this, if we transform too little, then the untransformed powers remain down there, turn up in one place or another, and we get those neoplasms, those carcinomatous neoplasms of which I spoke yesterday. In this way, we can follow the process of falling ill, or of being injured, as Troxler put it in the first half of the 19th century, of injury in later life. Comparison is then also possible with regard to the situation with childhood diseases, for these clearly cannot have the same kind of origin, seeing that they develop in childhood when nothing has as yet been transformed. Yet once we have come to know the causes of disease in later life, we have also gained the ability to observe the situation with the causes of disease in childhood. In a way, one sees the same thing, though in a different aspect. We find that there is also too much power of organization in mind and soul in the organism when childhood diseases develop. This shows itself particularly well to anyone who has developed the ability to see things in this direction when considering the phenomenon of scarlet fever, of measles in childhood. They can then see how something which would otherwise function normally in the child's organism, the element of mind and spirit, begins to bumble about, is more active than it really should be. The whole course of these diseases can be understood the moment we are really able to see how this bumbling about in the organism is the underlying cause of the disease. From there, it is not far. Please pay careful attention to this, for I never go a step further than the thoughts that have gone before do justify, even if I am only able to refer to things briefly. But I always make it clear how far it is possible to go. I am not saying that a conclusion is drawn here, but only that one is close to giving recognition to something which it is extraordinarily important to recognize for real knowledge. If we have reached the point where we are able to perceive that when disease develops later in life that goes in the direction of neoplasia, meaning that there is too much organizing power, resulting in a surplus, as it were, in an organizational island, we are close to saying to ourselves, if later life thus refers back to earliest childhood, then the principle apparent in childhood refers back to the time before birth, or, let us say, conception. It refers back to the individual's existence in spirit and soul, which he had before being clothed in a physical body. Such an individual has simply brought too much of the spirit and soul element with him from life before being a human being, from life before earth, and this surplus comes into its own in the childhood diseases. In future, the only thing possible will be to allow oneself to drift from the fruitless materialistic thinking in which we are caught up today, especially in physiology and therapy, and consider things from the point of view of mind and soul. And it will be found that the things which arise in spiritual science do not do so because the spiritual investigator is not properly based in physical research, being an amateur, as it were, in physical research. In parenthesis, I definitely say that many who call themselves spiritual investigators are indeed such amateurs, but that is not how it should be. A spiritual scientist does not have to be too limited in his knowledge of physical research to be a spiritual scientist. He will be a spiritual scientist when he is more knowledgeable in that field than scientists usually are. If he understands the phenomena more clearly, the phenomena themselves will drive him into the sphere of mind and soul, especially where we have to speak of sickness. Then there are the words, quote, "To gain insight into the spirit is to destroy the spirit," close quote. Well, it really is equally absurd. But these words, too, point to something that has to be perceived and understood. For just as the words, quote, "to gain insight into nature is to create nature," close quote, refer us to early childhood and, in fact, to the time before birth, if we broaden them in the right way, so the words, quote, "to gain insight into the spirit is to destroy the spirit," close quote, refer to the end of an individual's life, to the principle in us that brings death. You only have to subscribe to these words, paradoxically, I'd say, that to gain insight into the spirit is to destroy the spirit, and you'll find that we must not go along with them. And yet they are there in life as something we are always asymptotically coming close to. For someone who does not simply rush into insight gaining, as we might put it, but develops the right way of knowing himself, to gain insight into the spirit, it means to see, to gain vision of, constant processes of degradation, constant processes of destruction in the human organism. Looking into the creative age of childhood, we see continuous building up processes, which, however, have the peculiarity that they dim the conscious mind. This is why we are half dreaming, half asleep in childhood, with the conscious mind not fully awake yet. Our own earthly spirituality, growth activity suppressing conscious mental powers, is something which really organizes us thoroughly. At the moment when this power enters into our conscious mind, it ceases to organize us to the degree to which it has done until then. And just as we are looking at the upbuilding powers when we look into the age of childhood, powers which do, however, dim consciousness, we look at destructive processes when we direct our vision to the fully developed thinking processes. But these have the capacity to make our conscious mind bright and clear. Modern physiology does not take this sufficiently into account, although the phenomena are as much in evidence as they can be. Take a look at the real phenomena of modern physiology, and you'll see that nothing can be more clearly shown on the basis of everything known about the physiology of the brain and the like than that with conscious processes in mind and soul, one is not dealing with some kind of powers of growth, some kind of powers to take in food, but with eliminatory processes, degradation, a slow, continuous dying process. Death is at work in us when we give ourselves up to the principle which is actually involved in our conscious awareness. And just as in looking at unconscious creative powers, we look to the beginning of life, so in looking at the powers of conscious ideation, which prove to be powers of destruction, we see the principle emerging which begins to take hold of us more and more as we grow into life on earth, break down the physical body, and finally take us toward earthly death. We are with those powers looking to the other end of life, to death. And we will not be able to understand birth and death, or, let us say, conception, birth, and death, unless we also consider the non-physical. The statement that to gain insight into the spirit is to destroy the spirit really is a way of saying, if we were to consider only the spirit, no longer looking at it more or less naively, but were to look at it the way we look at the natural world outside us, we would have to stem back the principle which lies in this conscious thinking, ideation, and sentient feeling activity, would have to prevent the breaking down process. This means we would, at that moment, have to tone down the power over the mental aspect, take inner conscious awareness down to unconsciousness, with the mental principle active unconsciously. We would reach a point where we created something spiritual out of ourselves, pushing it out to the outside, as it were. But we would not be able to follow this with the conscious mind, for we cannot take the organization into this breaking down process, this process in mind and spirit. We are therefore able to say that organizing processes are such that in a way we have the structural framework of the human organism, plate one, top, though this is now an abstract way of looking at it, with the organizing power, plate one, below, entering into it as a principle in mind and soul. In the other case, the second case I spoke of, we have here the framework of the human organism, but do not allow the organizing power, which to a degree dims down conscious awareness, to enter into it, but seek to drive out that organizing power into which we now seek to gain insight as spirit. Plate 2. Yet our capital I, or self, cannot follow this, being bound to the organism. We have the other side, the side where human beings do begin to develop spiritual principles, above all will activity. Due to being filled with will activity, which remains unconscious and in a way is asleep, dreaming, we bring forth a spiritual and soul principle from our organization without conscious awareness. We have the other side, the manic raging side, where the human being goes mad in the various forms of mental diseases, as they are called, though these are nothing more than that. Here, with physical diseases, we have an element of mind and soul that does not belong in the physical organism. See plate one below. And with the, in quotes, mental diseases, we drive forth from the physical and etheric something which should really be inside, but we drive it forth from the organism. See plate two. Today we see light cast on something which we discovered yesterday, but from another side. And the situation is that this point of view provides more guidance for us. Tomorrow we'll see the fruitful consequences we get exactly from these points of view, consequences that will definitely find confirmation in life, proving to be the most practical application in life, in medicine, therapeutic practice. When we inquire into the causes of a physical illness, we must ultimately really look for them in a spiritual principle having lost its way in the organism. One should certainly not take an abstract view. People who know nothing of the way in which the principle of soul and spirit is connected with the physical organism really should not bring in their opinion here. For we can only identify the specific situation where there is too much organizing power somewhere in an organ, a hypertrophic organizing power, I'd say, if we know the principle of spirit and soul, which, in itself, is just as real as the physical body has liver, stomach, and so on, as tangible organs. People have no idea of this in psychology. If we know it, and its parts, its elements, just as we know elements that are physical and material. Knowing the relationships between the two, we can consider the condition which develops in a person, often even in mind or spirit and soul, so that there is a kind of hyper-organization in some organ or other. With everything but external injuries, we would be able to refer to some such cause and origin. If, on the other hand, we concern ourselves with mental diseases, as they are called, we will remain abstract if we think we can gain anything from half a phenomenology. If we think that we can gain anything by simply describing the abnormalities in mind and soul, though it is, of course, very useful to describe them. Such descriptions are very good for causing a sensation among lay people. For it is always interesting how someone who is foolish deviates from the normal in life. Rare things are always interesting, and in our day the situation is that something which deviates from normal life in this way is at least still a rarity. But there can never be a question of stopping at this point. Above all, there can be no question of letting something move in the direction of the amateurish lay opinion that mind and soul are sick, and it is possible to cure mind and soul somehow with measures in mind and soul. That is what abstract thinkers dream of. But it is especially with the mental diseases that the most important thing to do is to point in every case to where the under-organization of some organ or other is to be found. Wanting truly to gain insight into a melancholy or hypochondria which has become a mental illness, we should not paddle around in the sphere of the psyche, but rather endeavor to consider the condition of the individual's abdominal region, how under-organization takes effect in the abdominal organization, how organizing power that is functioning below normal is in a way making something precipitate, to use the chemical term. A chemist precipitates something from a solution and the like, causing a sediment to form. We must endeavor to see how reducing organizing power causes something physical, material, to drop out, precipitate, that would otherwise be fully penetrated by the organizing power. How this then exists in the organism as physical matter, is deposited, and what is going on in the liver, bile, stomach, heart, or lung. These processes are not as easy to investigate as we would like in an age when people turn to cruder methods. For histology, the study of tissues under the microscope, is also a crude method. Psychologies will be needed for such an investigation, but it is always necessary to trace mental diseases back to physical conditions. This does, however, make them less interesting, but that is how it is. It is, of course, more interesting when a hypochondriac is able to say that his psyche is in some way or other involved in the cosmos of spirit and soul, than if we are able to demonstrate that there is an under-organizing power in his liver. Or it is more interesting to look for the cause of hysteria in mind and soul, let us say, than having to point merely to metabolic processes in the sexual organs when speaking of hysterical phenomena, or whatever other metabolic irregularities spread in the organism. But we won't gain insight into these things unless we study them in this way. The aim in the science of the spirit is certainly not always just to look for the spirit. We may leave this to spiritualists and other interesting, because rare, people, sadly only too rarely rare. We do not speak of spirit, spirit, spirit all the time in the science of the spirit, but seek to trace the spirit's influences. And it is exactly this which will get us to grasp the material aspect in the right place. Far from being proud to explain mental diseases in an abstract way, referring to mind and spirit, the way is to come to a material view, especially for mental diseases. We are thus able to say that the science of the spirit points to and explains the interesting phenomenon which existed in psychiatry just a short time ago, perhaps with Griesinger, or in the time before Griesinger. A relatively short time ago, psychiatrists would at least still consider the physical condition as well when making a diagnosis. What has become more and more common today? That psychiatrists crowd their literature with syndromes that are merely descriptions of abnormalities in mind and soul. Materialism has actually taken people directly into an abstract sphere of mind and soul in this field. This is a tragedy for materialism, for it has in fact taken people out of the material sphere. This is what is so strange about materialism, that at certain points it actually leads to lack of understanding, an inability to grasp the material. Someone who follows the spirit as a genuine fact will also follow it where it influences the material sphere, and then withdraws from it so that matter is deposited, as is the case with mental diseases. I had to present these things to create a basis, so that tomorrow I may also suggest some guiding principles for therapeutic work. The things we find if we thus fructify the sphere of physiology and therapy with the science of the spirit also have a social aspect. It is a peculiarity of life that wherever, in looking for knowledge today, we do not withdraw, being abstract into scholarly existence inimical to life, but look for it in taking a view of human existence, human togetherness, that is full of life, such a living search for knowledge will actually take us into a social sphere. An extraordinarily interesting social phenomenon shows itself in current developments. We see humanity divided up into middle class and aristocratic people above on the one hand, and into proletarian life below on the other. The one-sidedly aristocratic style of life leads to people being caught up in a false seeking for the spirit, materialism in the spiritual sphere, whilst proletarian life is caught up in a certain spiritualism in the material sphere. What does it mean to say spiritualism in the material sphere? It means to stop in one's search for the origins of existence. Proletarians have developed scientific materialism as a philosophy of life at the same time as the aristocratic element developed materialistic views of the spirit. The proletarians have become materialists, the aristocrats spiritualists. For if you find spiritualists among proletarians, this is not something grown in their own proletarian soil, but mimicry. It is copied, merely something which has come across from the aristocratic and middle-class element, like an infection. I'll be talking about infection tomorrow. If, on the other hand, you see materialism developed among aristocrats so that spirits let themselves be seen materially, as if looking at flames, so that materialism is taken into the most spiritual elements, and the intention is to see the spiritual in material terms, this arises from the original decadent one-sidedness, where people step outside their humanity as a whole, out of the totality, and turn one-sidedly to the aristocratic and the middle-class element, the latter having caught some of the aristocratic disease. If proletarians, feeling compelled to stop in matter when they want to use their minds, their spirit, because they are not lifted out of it through the appropriate education and the like, when they are forced to stay in the material sphere in their search for the spirit, their philosophy of life will be materialism. This has been developed by proletarians as a philosophy, for instance, in the materialistic view taken of history. Materialism was developed as spiritualism by more aristocratic people, for spiritualism is materialism, a masked materialism, where one will not even honestly admit to it being such, but lies and maintains that those who subscribe to it are spiritual individuals. Following this reminiscence, let us continue tomorrow, the end of Lecture 2.